It is 6 minutes after 12, and this is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas, 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, June 27th, 2019. Ahead today, a new documentary about a Fayetteville resident's role in World War II premieres at the Pryor Center next week. We'll talk with the director. After our show this afternoon on Here and Now, 20 Democratic candidates are trying to stand out from the crowd in two batches in two debates. Will frontrunner Joe Biden be attacked by any of the pack? Will someone have a breakout moment? Will the debates shake up the polls or shrink the field? The latest from the debates on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR, beginning at 1 on 91.3. All right, the bad news. You've missed the morning presentation of Wizard of Oz through puppetry at the Bentonville Public Library. The good news? Another presentation by Stevens Puppets is scheduled for 2:30 this afternoon. The performance uses handcrafted wooden marionettes and a musical score. It's free. It's open to the public. You can find out more at bentonvillelibrary.org. This is Ozarks at Large. This Is My Brave Incorporated is a national nonprofit dedicated to ending the stigma surrounding mental illness through storytelling. Since its debut show in 2014, This Is My Brave has produced more than 50 unique shows across the country, featuring more than 700 storytellers sharing personal stories about mental illness. The Northwest Arkansas version is returning to Bentonville for its third year this fall, and producers are meeting with potential participants this weekend. Laura Levine and Jason LeCompte are counselors at Bentonville Counseling Collective and two of the show's producers. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda met them at their office yesterday to learn more about the project. Lauren says she read about This Is My Brave in the Oprah magazine in the summer of 2016.
I am a counselor and I am an expressive arts therapist, so with a background in theater, and so this just spoke so strongly to me. And I called up Amber Brown, who is my BFF, and I knew she would be like, let's do this. So she thought it was amazing, and so that Monday, I called up Jen Marshall, who's the executive director.
Founder of it.
And said, like, hey, how do we bring it to Bentonville?
So can you tell me a little bit about how, I guess, the first 2 years now have gone?
They've gone wonderfully. We put together a really great show the first year. I think we had 15 participants. So, and that's generally what we'll have, between 12 and 15 people. We were at the White Auditorium at NWAC and had a pretty full house. Then the second year was even better because people had heard about it the first year. And so that's why the audience was bigger. And also we had, it was a little easier to find participants, people who were wanting to do it because they had seen it the year before and were interested in maybe doing it the next year. It's an amazing experience for us, for the participants, for the audience. It's beautiful.
It's incredibly powerful production, both to witness it and guide it, but also like for folks to be in it. The impact that we've had is it's incredible.
So it is a production,
yes,
on stage, but people are sharing their own stories. Mm-hmm. So what is that like for you as a director? Because it's not someone else's piece. Typically a play is something that's written, it's your piece to interpret. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Isn't it a little harder to interpret someone else's personal story?
That's a great question.
It is. So this is when I came on last year, Amber and Lauren were excited about my theater background as well. Mm-hmm. And I felt like the best thing that I could do is, I mean, I think we both, probably the three of us, share a sensibility for what looks and sounds good on a stage. Mm-hmm. And so the material, the content itself, was less important. What was more important was turning it into a watchable production, mm-hmm. right? And so that's really what we did, was just to help each participant shape their story or shape their piece a little bit, so that it was production ready, or I guess, right?
And so the first year we did We followed the format that the organization recommends, that we have a first meet up with all the cast members after we've met each of them individually, and then maybe meet one more time, and then dress rehearsal in a show. And then last year, I think it just kind of formed organically, we decided, let's just let people know that we're available every weekend at this place and time if they want to keep workshopping their piece with other participants, with us, go back, come back a week later with, you know, taking the feedback and reshaping it, get familiar and comfortable. These are not actors. Right. So get familiar and comfortable with sharing and getting feedback. And we will do that again this year because it helps, I think, the decrease some anxiety around public speaking and sharing in that way and feeling that they have a really, they've had solid feedback and they've really tightened up their piece.
And not only confidence in their piece, but also the connection, the bond that they make with each other
right.
in the course of the production that helps them to feel safe and feel ready just to be brave.
Yes, be brave.
Yeah, to go up there and be brave.
Yeah.
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 You mentioned how it's so impactful in a powerful show. Why is it so important, or how is it important for people to be sharing their own personal stories? Because there's lots of plays about mental health or you know, and specific types of mental health, but what makes this so different and perhaps more impactful than, say, a written play?
So I think those are real people telling their real stories about themselves or a loved one. It's not just if they'd experienced it, but themselves or a loved one and what that was like living with them. Or what it is like living with them. And so it's real stories. These are real people. And I think the, without stealing the phrase, but it's more like, okay, me too. Oh, me too. Like, and they're really speaking about it. And maybe I'm not so strange. We've had a lot of like, oh, maybe I don't have to keep this a secret. Maybe I can reach out for help. Maybe I can make friends. Maybe all the things.
Well, and that's exactly the point of this whole thing is to help reduce the stigma around mental health. So the more we can talk about it, the more frank the presentation or as honest as we can be, it takes the sting out of it for a lot of people, right?
It's not a secret anymore.
Right, right. So my experience living with it, either as someone with mental illness or someone who is a witness to or, you know, loved one that has it, it really is. That's part of what makes it so powerful and why it's important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, we're really clear that, and it's important, this is not therapy. We need to keep the boundaries clear because we're therapists that, and not all producers are therapists and not all producers have a background in theater. It's so I think we're just like awesome that way.
We do have a unique situation.
We know how, you know, as therapists, how to create boundaries and safety in ways that need to be thought about and then how to shape a show. That's because we have off a theater background.
And to also monitor the mental health and well-being of the participants along the way.
Exactly.
Right.
And look and see things that might need to be addressed.
Right.
So it's not therapy, but there's no doubt it's like so therapeutic.
It is.
And I don't think they, so far my experience has been that I don't think people get quite how transformational it can be until they've actually done the piece in front of a large audience and the feedback that they get. We get, we create a something for the lobby or the area, the public area, so that with each participant's photos and then an opportunity to give written feedback to each person so that they can see that later after the show. So they get a lot of really amazing sharing.
So auditions are this weekend.
Yes. Can I say something about that? It's the organization, and I get that is a word that makes sense.
Audition.
Right. I have... and all the literature says audition. And I have been vocal about, don't use that word, but I don't know what else to call it. Meet the producers.
Yeah.
Come and pitch an idea. I have sort of a normal level of anxiety, and I have a theater background, and auditions scare me a lot.
They scare a lot of folks.
So, yeah. Right. Yeah. And so a person with anxiety or depression or mental illness of any sort, going to an audition, not so much. So I want to be really, we want to be really clear that this is just an opportunity to sit with us, and by virtue of the fact that we've created that format where we can help workshop the piece, they may not even have something written yet.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't have to be a finished piece by any means.
Nothing
yeah.
like, hey, I have this idea, and I just feel like that would work, and we're like, okay, we'll go with it. Let's help you out. We've spent more, some people more intense one-on-one time through the course of the production, creating the production. So it's by no means an audition. It's a come and meet us, talk to us, get some more information about the show, talk to us about your idea, and pretty much you're in.
So this pitch session
yeah.
sounds fairly informal. And like you said, you just kind of come with an idea.
Welcome a written piece and come and share that. Sure. If you've got a piece that you're just burning to share, of course, come prepared.
So those are the basic parameters. Have an idea.
So we're talking a lot about having written pieces, but I want to be clear that this is any art form. So
right. It could be dance, it could
right.
be song.
We want we've had stand up.
Yep.
We haven't had a dancer yet, but we've had we've had visual art. We've had a duo on stage, or well, they didn't actually end up coming together on the stage.
Mm, that's okay.
But
poetry.
So
there was some slam poetry. Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So any art form we can work with. We also make sure to have a screen behind each person, so that if they have things they want to show during their show. Oh, the first year we had the woman. So wanted to do it, but her anxiety would not allow her to be on stage. But she created a short film and showed it.
What else should we know? Anything else?
Something that draws me to this, that drew me to it initially and continues to draw me to it, is that in order to see things change in our culture, in our society, in a positive way, we need to have a measure of social courage.
Yes.
And so this to me represents the very best of that. It's
yeah.
Because it is anyone and everyone. Mental health impacts almost everyone,
yes.
right? If
yeah.
you're not living with it, you know someone who is, right? And the only way that we change our culture, our ideas around the stigma of mental health, is to stand up and talk about it. That's one of the
yeah.
best ways to do it. So I think that's really important to me, that measure of social courage, right?
It just reduces the power, and then it also allows people to know that it's possible, and to feel well, and we hear some pretty dark stories, and wow, look at you now.
Mm-hmm.
That's so encouraging.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for interviewing us.
Yeah, that's great.
That was Lauren Levine and Jason LeCompte, two producers of This Is My Brave Northwest Arkansas. They spoke with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda at their Bentonville office yesterday. The production is scheduled for October 3rd, and auditions are this Saturday and Sunday at Bentonville Counseling Collective. You can reserve your spot by visiting thisismybrave.org/events and clicking on the Northwest Arkansas event. If you can't make it this weekend, the producers are willing to meet another time. Just give Lauren a call or text at 479-236-4172. This is Ozarks at Large. A sleuth of five exhibition bears, that's what you call them, a sleuth of bears, rescued from confined captivity, were released last October into a forest habitat built just for them at Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge in Carroll County. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich takes us there.
Huggy, a massive young Russian brown bear, ambles up this morning to greet Tanya Smith, president and founder of Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge. Huggy, along with five other bears, moved into this new 2.5-acre woodland habitat on an isolated section of the refuge last autumn.
Yes, this place is awesome because they can actually go out and build tree nests, ground nests. They get to forage for their own food, which is really awesome. They we do feed them up every night, so if they want to have that diet, they can. But we've caught them eating worms and grubs and tearing apart logs. And, you know, it's just so great to see these captive bears getting to enjoy a little bit of the wild.
Huggy lives with two black bears, Holly and Lolly. Three others, Xena, Kodigy, and Popper, live across the way in a separate forest habitat. They were among 115 big cats and bears Smith and her team rescued from a failing Colorado wild animal facility and rehomed them to other sanctuaries in September 2016.
Before they came to the refuge, the cage was really small. In Colorado at that project, they had pallet mulch down. While we were there in Colorado, I actually had to Lori, one of our assistant curators, was there, and she actually pulled a staple out of Huggy's paw. So, you know, they couldn't have it any better than they do right here.
The new bear habitat features covered constructed living quarters, concrete winter dens, and special gates they can push open to get into the woods, Huggy and Holly demonstrate, with a destination down the mountain in mind. Huggy lumbers into a massive aquacrete swimming pool, snorkeling his way through the cold water, turning over, showing his belly, while Holly and Lolly lounge along the edge, observing him. The entire bear habitat costs $150,000 to build, with cost savings provided by staff labor, and is enclosed with towering super reinforced fencing.
Got 460 acres here to develop. So, you know, with contributions and with people being able to donate, and right now we have a matching grant for $40,000. So if anybody out there can make a donation, they can actually double their donation by making a donation right now.
Proceeds are currently going towards improving the rescue's critically needed water well system. Turpentine Creek is home to 97 big cats and 12 bears, the most popular being Bam Bam, an interactive grizzly who lives up the mountain with the big cats near the entrance where the tourists come in his own private habitat. Bam Bam and the other bears consume fresh fruits and veggies, which comprise three-quarters of their diet, supplemented with meat, which Huggy needs especially since he's still growing. Tanya Smith walks across the path to the other bear habitat and gestures to a ground nest built by Popper, a wild bear that needed to be rescued.
But she's from Florida, and that was one of our motivations, is to be able to provide her where she could live as close to the wild as she can and actually live in captivity. So she's safe here.
Staff were not clear at first how the bears would acclimate to their new wild habitat.
In November, when we let these animals out, you know, it was getting cold and they went into their torpor, and we didn't really see them any activity until spring. Now, Popper, when she got out of her, she had not come back into the night house at all. She stayed out. She built her ground nest, a huge ground nest. And every time we would drive by, her little ears would just pop up and she'd look around for her surroundings, but just to make sure everything was okay. And then she would nest back down. So it's awesome to see her out there doing wild bear behavior in captivity.
Popper, Smith says, is now teaching the other bears to subsist in the wild.
And that was our goal, is to introduce her to those bear and hopefully that she would teach them how to live more as natural bear in the wild.
All the bears are in excellent health, but for safekeeping, they undergo annual physicals inside the Jackson Memorial Veterinary Hospital, built on the premises in 2016, named after Tanya Smith's parents. The teaching hospital, which is quiet today, contains an ambulance bay, a medical intake, diagnostic clinic, holding and recovery facility, as well as a surgery with full telemetry.
Yeah, so when we bring the bears in, this table can accommodate 3,000 pounds. So actually that table has wheels on it and we can roll it out to put the bear on right off the scale and bring it right into the vet hospital where it's under camera. And the vet has a computer here, so we have an ultrasound machine that somebody donated, and we're greatly appreciative of these donated items because they're very expensive, but it provides us with a way to make sure that the care is given properly to the animals. And this table allows them to be at an ergonomically correct position as they do these surgeries, so it's a lot better for the people, too.
Black bears were once native to Arkansas, but were hunted almost to extinction in the mid-1800s for pelts and meat. Arkansas wildlife biologists, a century later, reintroduced several hundred northern black bears to Arkansas, which today number around 3,000, a big success story, they say. But bear enthusiasts can now observe black bears up close summer, fall, winter, and spring in their Ozark habitat via curated tours booked online at turpentinecreek.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. It's about 26 and a half minutes after noon.
91.3 is supported by the City of Eureka Springs, featuring the history, beauty, and charm of a Victorian village. With over 100 shops and galleries, Eureka Springs offers various shopping and dining experiences, overnight accommodations, plus spa retreats and day trips. Eureka Springs getaway information available at eurekasprings.org. The July 4th Fireworks Spectacular, featuring Sona, Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, is Thursday, July 4th at the Walmart Amp. The community is invited to a patriotic concert featuring songs like Stars and Stripes Forever and the 1812 Overture, capped off by a fireworks display. General admission lawn tickets are available with blankets allowed. AmpTickets.com for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. Next week, the ciders created by Black Apple Crossing in downtown Springdale will migrate south. A variety of drinks will be on tap in restaurants and bars in Little Rock, expanding the Black Apple reach beyond Northwest and West Arkansas. Tuesday, we met with some of the principals involved with Black Apple to discuss the progress. Leo Orpin, founder of Black Apple, says the cidery began as a 700-square-foot tap room on Emma Avenue. So small, Leo says, he leased out the front part of his building.
And we were barely using any of the production facility. And now we have filled the building out. We filled everything out. It went from having four ciders total that we had in the tap room to eight. We're actually about to expand that even further in the tap room and have a lot more experimental things.
He says the four-day-a-week schedule of business then has expanded to every day of the week now, and the initial five-year business plan was tossed in the second year of operation because of the rapid growth. The ciders are now available on tap in about 150 bars and restaurants in Northwest Arkansas and Fort Smith. This spring, cans of certain ciders made by Black Apple hit the shelves in just over 100 retailers. Leo Orpin says up next, Central Arkansas and Little Rock.
We get to play with some of that Deep South culinary tradition that really like extends from the Delta and the Mississippi. And it just really fusing with those kind of things is, I think, both our challenge, but also our opportunity. And we're really, really excited for it.
He says being the only cidery in Arkansas, it makes sense to expand the Black Apple territory. But further, he says, this expansion reflects deep Arkansas agricultural roots for him and for others at Black Apple. For example, he says Bryce Martin, the distribution manager, is from the Arkansas Delta.
My partner, Trey Holt, he is actually owns a farm in England, Arkansas, central Arkansas, their rice farm. And then mine even had some farming land in the River Valley. So having those agricultural roots to kind of go back, because we source so much locally and regionally, and now we see ourselves getting all sorts of different ingredients statewide, but also the culinary side of things, where, you know, we have that Ozark sustenance up here that we love to tap into, and we do like these different pairings, and our different flavors that we work with really play off of that.
The first step in Central Arkansas will include taps of some of the Black Apple mainstays, the hibiscus, the semi-sweet, and two summer seasonals, pineapple and grapefruit. Orpin says after customers become familiar with the brand, Black Apple will seek distribution of the canned ciders in Central Arkansas retail locations. Bryce Martin, in charge of Black Apple distribution, says the initial Greater Little Rock presence will include more than two dozen restaurants.
So we'll be in over 35 locations. 11 of those will have launch events at. So we're doing a large variety, different types of events throughout the week. So we've got everything from a cider makers panel where you can meet the cider maker and ask questions about how you home ferment cider. We're doing a dog treat giveaway at a dog-friendly bar where you can bring your pups in, drink some cider all afternoon.
In a way, the distribution of kegs away from Springdale in Northwest Arkansas brings the business plan of Black Apple full circle. Leo Orpin says the root of the cidery was not to have a tasting room open to the public with live music on Fridays and trivia nights and such. He says they had planned on distribution only.
What's crazy is this downtown Springdale community just embraced us, and really embraced us hard by saying, we need a place to drink. Why can't this be it? And so that's why we opened up the little speakeasy, and that's kind of where the tap room originated from community engagement.
For cider lovers and cider converts, the Emma Avenue location has proven to be pretty popular. It also provides the Black Apple staff a chance to hold in-house launch parties for new flavors, as they did last night for a cucumber mint.
Oh, it's so refreshing. It's a semi-sweet, but the mint is very, very subtle, but it's just a refreshing, like almost summer cocktail-ish style drink. What do you think, Bryce?
I think it's a good poolside cider, you know? Definitely something you'd want to take a growler home for if you're planning on mowing the yard or chilling around the pool all day. And also, I think it's particularly appealing with lighter foods. Like, it kind of makes me want to eat a salad, honestly.
You can find out more about the cidery, keep up with other seasonal flavors as they are developed, and find locations and retailers that carry Black Apple at blackapplecrossing.com. And on Sunday's Weekend Ozarks at Large, Leo will be back to explain why having a job that invites experimentation is a good thing.
I think that's just entrepreneurism, like it just in general, right? Like you have to have that want in order to get into something like this. But then to take a culinary art like making cider, which not a lot of people see it that way, like the science behind that and the experimentation behind that, like that's what gets you up in the morning.
More from Black Apple on Weekend Ozarks at Large. That's Sunday morning at 9 on 91.3. As the end of June gets closer, we want to check in with Lee Wood about the status of our effort to raise, somewhat quietly, $30,000 before the end of June, which happens to also be the end of our fiscal year. Lee is with me in the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio. Lee, where are we?
Well, we're so close. So we met our challenge earlier this week. We were looking to raise $12,000 to meet that challenge. Then we could add another $12,000 in, because we're looking, as you said, to raise $30,000. And as of right now, we are about $417 away.
About $417 away. So a very good chance by the time we have Ozarks at Large evening edition tonight at 7, we will have successfully raised the $30,000.
I hope you're right. Yes.
What can someone do if they have between $1 and $417, but you can go above that.
You can, yes.
How does someone between now and the end of the fiscal year at midnight June 30th contribute?
They go to supportkuaf.com, and of course, we try to make it as easy as possible. You can give in any amount of your choosing. You can choose to make a one-time gift or set up a sustaining membership where you give a monthly gift. You can use your credit card or set up a bank draft. If you work for the University of Arkansas, you can set up a payroll deduction. So there's lots of ways to give, and we just want everyone to participate, because the more listeners we have contributing to this public radio station, the stronger our base of support is, and the stronger we can go into the new fiscal year, knowing we can budget and bring you this programming you rely on.
Contributions in the amount of your choice.
Absolutely.
SupportKUAF.com. Lee Wood is our outgoing membership director, but soon to become general manager at 91.3 KUAF. Thank you, Lee.
Thanks, Kyle.
All right, next week, a life worth learning about will be the subject of a new documentary premiering at the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History on the Fayetteville Square. The Lover's Cup central figure is Dr. Philip Trapp of Fayetteville, a World War II veteran, author, academic, and legendary figure in the University of Arkansas Department of Psychological Science. The Lover's Cup director, Kimberly Relier-Guin, came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio yesterday. She says her film concentrates on his World War II experiences.
He went in as a Navy officer. He's what they called back then a 90-day wonder. And what that means is what normally took 3 years in Annapolis, 3 to 4 years to train, they were so desperate for well-trained officers, they trained him in 90 days. It was very intense training. So he went in as a Navy officer at age 21. And yeah, that he became a wave commander. He was basically in the amphibious corps, which today I think is the equivalent of like the Marine, the Navy SEALs,
right.
The Navy SEALs, correct. And so he was in the most dangerous of the most dangerous branch. And he actually was, as a wave commander, took the troops into Iwo Jima and dropped them off.
And is it true he saw the flag, the iconic flag raising on Iwo Jima?
Yes, Dr. Trapp saw the flag being raised on Iwo Jima. And there's not many people left that can you will be able to meet and say that.
He's 95 years old.
Yes, he is.
How many times did you meet with him for this film, The Lover's Cup?
I met with Dr. Trapp probably at least 10 times over the course of 2 years. Because this is such a huge subject, it required a lot of research. And I wanted for him to tell the story. I didn't want to use a narrator. I wanted it to be in his words. So that's why I met with him several times and we did lots of interviews so that I could edit each of his sound bites to create the story.
You can't get his whole life in this film, obviously.
No.
Because he's an academic and so many things.
Yes, he has so much. And I decided to use World War II as the vehicle to tell this character-driven story. Because he's an incredible man. He's one of the greatest people I've ever known. And I feel so blessed to have had the opportunity to meet him and build this relationship. He's truly one of the most compassionate people you will ever meet. But also, he is such an optimist. I mean, he literally, after the war, he gave up his Navy whites. He gave up everything except one item because he went on to get his PhD in psychology so he could dedicate his life to helping people that had suffered from the war. And back then, of course, we didn't have PTSD, but he knew there were at least over 500,000 neuropsychiatric cases, and he wanted to help people, and he dedicated his life to doing that.
We don't want to give too much away about the film, but that desire to help is the inspiration for the title, The Lover's Cup.
That's correct. Well, yes. Another interesting thing about Dr. Trapp is he was one of the first Americans that got to go into Tokyo after the peace treaty signing. And he had the ship's jeep, and he was able to go. He actually went to a Tokyo university, because he was a college student, and he wanted to check it out. And he actually met a professor. She was a Japanese mother of two, and she'd received her PhD in English from Berkeley. So this is in 1945, which is pretty incredible. And he met her at the university, and she and her two daughters were starving. I mean, Tokyo was destroyed.
And this is just months or weeks after the devastation of Japan felt from
exactly,
the bombs.
Exactly. So he met this mother and her two daughters, and her husband, ironically, had been killed. He was, I think, in the Japanese Air Force, and he had been killed. So anyway, they struck up this relationship, and he said, I'm going to help you. So he took food. He brought her food every day for she and her daughters for the duration of him being there in Japan and fed, you know, made sure they had plenty to eat. And then on the last day, she gave them this special gift. And to find out more about that, you'll have to come see the film.
He has this legacy, too, of making sure that professionals get more education. I mean, he helped the legislation in Arkansas that required continuing education for people.
Yes, he did. And he was one of the forerunners for the University of Arkansas that helped with the diversity in the athletics. And I'm not an expert on that, so I have read all, and I've helped edit some of his memoirs, part of his memoirs, but he really had the courage to stand up for what was right, and not just here at the University of Arkansas, but actually throughout the country. He did a lot of good things.
Though not a Fayetteville or Arkansas native, he's lived here since the early 1950s, right?
Yes, yes. He was one of the, he helped found the Department of Psychology here at the University of Arkansas.
Were you ever overwhelmed? Because how long is your film?
My film is 55 minutes, which is a pretty long film, especially for a grad student to do on their own.
Still, were you ever overwhelmed with trying? Was it ever frustrating to figure out what wasn't going to make it in that 55 minutes about Dr. Trapp's life?
One of the most challenging things making a documentary film is figuring out what to cut, because there is so much. And I would have loved to have done a 2-hour film on his life, but of course, you know, with the advice of my professors, I couldn't do that. And I probably could have cut a little bit more out of this. But I chose to focus on World War II because I felt that that was a pretty powerful vehicle to tell a story.
Do you think you're more optimistic because you've met him and spent time with him?
I am definitely more optimistic because of him. I've talked to some of his friends and colleagues in this process, inviting them, and they all say the same thing. Honestly, he uses the analogy of a kaleidoscope, that, you know, if you're having a hard time, you know, you look in the kaleidoscope and it looks a certain way, and all you have to do is just shake it up and look, and it's a completely different picture. And I think that is so true. And also one of the best things that I want to share real quickly that he's shared a lot with others is that he, and it's really a pivotal moment in the film, but he talks about how when he landed, when they were landing at Iwo Jima, he felt the same intense anxiety as he had when he was walking across campus as a college student in Ohio getting ready to take a history exam. And he said to himself, I mean, here he was, possibly minutes from losing his life, and he said to himself, if I ever make it out of this war, I will never allow myself to get overly stressed in situations that just don't matter. And that's one of the great things that came out of the war for him, is he was able, it gave him perspective. So for the rest of his life, when things were critical or he, you know, things piled up or he felt really stressed, he was able to ask himself, well, hey, would you rather be doing this or would you rather be landing troops in Iwo Jima? And that was a powerful analogy, and it's something that has helped me a lot. I'm often reminded of that. I hear his voice in my head whenever I get overly stressed or anxious.
Kimberly Relier-Guin's film, The Lover's Cup, will be shown Tuesday night beginning at 6 at the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. The screening is free and open to the public.
91.3 is supported by the Scott Family Amazium, inviting families across the Ozarks to make every day amazing. Open Wednesday through Monday, the Amazium ignites curiosity in children of all ages through interactive experiences in science, technology, engineering, art, and math. Located at 1009 Museum Way in Bentonville. Information at amazium.org. Single parents interested in a career in the medical field are encouraged to apply to the Single Parent Scholarship Fund of Northwest Arkansas. Applications for certifications and allied health degrees are now open. Up to $2,000 can be earned and used towards training for dental and medical assistants, medical billing, and more. 935-4888 or Single Parent Scholarship Fund of NWA.org. to apply or for more information. KUAF is giving away tickets to the 2019 Spaceberry Music Festival, July 4th through the 6th on the farm in Eureka Springs. This three-day jam and funk festival welcomes Forgotten Space, Grateful Dead Tribute, Friends of the Family 10-Year Anniversary Jam, Arkansas, and others. Winners announced Friday, June 28th during Ozarks at Large. KUAF.com to register or for more information.
Tomorrow on a Friday Ozarks, Otto the Otter. Keep Arkansas Beautiful has a new mascot, and we'll find out more on tomorrow's noon edition of Ozarks at Large on 91.3 KUAF. The capital campaign for Theater Squared's building fund is past the 90% completion mark. The milestone is reached with the aid of a $2.9 million commitment from the state of Arkansas's Rainy Day Fund, authorized by Governor Asa Hutchinson. Theater Squared had established a public goal of $9 million of the overall $31.5 million project budget. The commitment from the state of Arkansas, along with prior contributions from the city of Fayetteville and the Fayetteville A&P Commission, closes out the public portion of the campaign.
Welcome to another edition of the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. I'm Paul Gatling. Coming up today, we'll have a report from Tyson Foods' annual Investor Day this past week on Wall Street. Plus, Roby Brock has an interview with attorney Alex Gray about a potential ballot referendum that would repeal an Arkansas law allowing optometrists to conduct limited eye surgeries. And a silver anvil for Arvest Bank. I'll explain that a little later. We'll have those stories after a quick break. We're glad you're with us for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report.
Support for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report is provided by the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. The Chamber's mission is to promote a pro-business, free enterprise agenda and prevent legislation, regulation, and rules that hinder business. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. First Security is proud to be only in Arkansas, and it shows in your banking experience. They offer smart solutions for personal and business banking, plus convenient services and community investment. That's because First Security is 100% focused on serving customers all across the state and nowhere else. It's local banking with local commitment. First Security. Bank better. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. And OneCom. OneCom provides communications options to help your business adapt to today's demands with tomorrow's technology. With opportunities in virtualization, redundancy, or maximizing your efficiency. Learn more at onecom.com. That's one-comm.com.
A coalition of Arkansas doctors is looking to deploy a rarely used ballot referendum to knock a new law off the books that would allow optometrists to perform eye surgeries and other procedures once limited to medically trained ophthalmologists. That group is called Safe Surgery Arkansas, which filed papers earlier this month at the state capitol to form a ballot question committee to coordinate a statewide referendum challenging Act 579 of 2019. That new law opens the door for licensed optometrists who were previously prohibited from using lasers, scalpels, and injections in their local practices to now perform those surgical procedures in Arkansas. Attorney Alex Gray drafted and filed the referendum and is representing Safe Surgery Arkansas. He spoke with Roby Brock recently about the issue, outlining the legal argument of the medical matter.
This whole debate over this eye surgery expansion scope of practice here, this was litigated in the Arkansas legislature that just ended. It had pretty strong numbers in terms of its passage in both the House and in the Senate. And some people would say that the people's representatives have spoken. Why does it need to go to a vote of the people, do you think?
This is a patient safety issue. Anytime you're expanding the scope of practice to allow non-medical doctors who, you know, have not gone to medical school and have not had the extended specialized training to do surgeries, whether it be on your eyes or your ears or your heart, or your knees, or whatever it may be, I mean, this is a public safety issue. And so we felt like, and kind of this grassroots effort, felt like it's important that the people actually be able to vote on this as opposed to, you know, maybe special interest influencing and advocating for their you know, respective yeah. clients on the issue.
You don't think that the medical arguments were fairly presented enough to have an equalized vote on this in the legislature? You think it was influenced by incorrect information or what?
Well, I think that people made their decisions early, maybe even before maybe they got all the information. There was a lot of information that showed the general public did not support this. And so, again, maybe the general public will support it and the act will stay in effect. But you know, maybe they won't, but we felt like it was important that because this is such an important public safety issue, and this is not just about, you know, eye surgeries. This is about a kind of, anytime you're allowing a surgery by a non-medical doctor, this goes beyond just an optometrist, ophthalmologist, you know,
you
debate.
You think there's a potential Pandora's box that could be opened on this?
Potentially.
So who's behind this? Is this an industry push behind this, or are there some particular individuals that are supportive of this and hoping to build that coalition out?
There are medical doctors that are, you know, that perform some of these surgeries. There are medical doctors that don't perform some of these surgeries. There are people who are neither medical doctors or have anything to do with the medical profession that are really concerned about the precedent that this sets, that we're going to allow non-medical doctors to perform surgeries. I mean, it's a huge leap. And like you said, this could easily open Pandora's box, because I'm sure there will be other subspecialties that will say, well, you know, we should be able to cut on people.
Right. So lastly, let's talk about precedent. This has only happened once before, as you and I have both mentioned. Is this going to be precedent setting in terms of doing a ballot question committee on overturning an initiated act? Will we see more of this in the future? Well, and is that good public policy?
Well, it's interesting because, again, it's only happened once in the last 50 years, but from 1964 to 1968, it happened three or four times. So for whatever reason, it just has not happened very frequently one time in the last, you know, several years. And so, you know, will it set a precedent? I'm not sure, but I think it's important that people know that this is an option, and it is a specific power that the people reserved to themselves in the Constitution before both of us were born. So, I mean, this is something. This is the people's state, and so at some point in time, you know, there are routes for the people to say, we're going to vote on this, and it's in the Constitution. So we don't feel like this is somehow. Although it may be unprecedented, we don't feel like it's something that will, you know, every act will get referred out or anything like that. But if there are public safety issues or there are other issues that groups, you know, want to have the people vote, or if, and again, this only gets on the ballot if the people sign petitions and petition that it be on the ballot. So, we'll see if it happens more frequently than once in the last 50 years. I anticipate that it may.
A group called Arkansans for Healthy Eyes has been formed by the state's optometrist to combat the potential ballot initiative. On the other side, Safe Surgery Arkansas has a little over a month left to get the necessary 53,941 signatures from registered Arkansas voters to put the referendum on the ballot in 2020. And in other news this past week, Tyson Foods officials visited Wall Street for the company's annual Investor Day on Thursday. And in honor of that occasion, on Wednesday, company chairman John Tyson and other Tyson Foods executives were invited to handle the time-honored tradition of ringing the closing bell at the New York Stock Exchange, ending the day's trading at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As for the investor conference, company officials outlined where they see the biggest opportunity for long-term growth moving forward. The company's prepared foods division is expected to be one of the most profitable segments. By 2023, in fact, Tyson Foods expects prepared food sales will approach nearly half of the total revenue for the company. Today, it's about 22%. And speaking of food, Arvest Bank's annual 1 Million Meals campaign has garnered recognition from the Public Relations Society of America at its annual Silver Anvil Awards. At this year's ceremony in New York earlier this month, Arvest Bank and its agency partner, the Sales Agency, were presented a Silver Anvil Award for last year's Million Meals campaign in the category of Most Effective Corporate Social Responsibility Campaign. In 2018, Arvest Bank provided a record 2.1 million meals benefiting local food partners in communities across its four-state footprint in Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas. That record, though, was broken this year. Just last week, Arvest officials announced that the 2019 campaign ended with a new record of 2.4 million meals. And if you are curious, and I know that you are, the Silver Anvil Award is meant to signify the forging of public opinion. They have been bestowed annually since 1944. And that's all the time we have today for the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report. We'll be back with another edition on Sunday morning at 9 a.m. on the weekend edition of Ozarks at Large here on KUAF. Until then, I'm Paul Gatling. Thanks for listening.
So many people to thank for making the show this Thursday. Contributors included Antoinette Grajeda and Jacqueline Froelich. Timothy Dennis mastered our show. The Northwest Arkansas Business Journal Report with Paul Gatling is part of our partnership with Talk Business and Politics. Our theme, written and performed by Daryl Sean. Ozarks at Large is a production of 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Lincoln. Back tomorrow at noon with Ozarks at Large. Tomorrow night at 7, please join us for a live broadcast as we celebrate the Generic Blues Show with Paul Kelso. Our second annual Summer Night Swing will feature live music from Jesse Dean and Buddy Shootin' the Motivators, plus beer from Ozark Brewing Company and wine from Keels Creek Winery and Art Gallery. It's a live program from the Fayetteville Public Library tomorrow night beginning at 7 on 91.3. And speaking of music in the library, we'll end with a song from the next band at the Mountain Street Stage Music Series, Rochelle Bradshaw and Hypnotion. That'll be Sunday afternoon at 2. This is their take on Redemption Song as recorded in the Furman Garner Performance Studio at KUAF. Antoinette Grajeda curates our end-of-show music, and she'll deliver more news and information about the region tomorrow morning at 5:30 and 7:30 with our morning newscast. Thank you for listening. Here is Rochelle Bradshaw and Hypnotion.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hands remained strong by the hands of the Almighty. Move forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? They're all I ever had. Redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear from atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. So won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? They're all I ever had. Redemption songs. Redemption songs. Oh, oh, yeah, yeah. Whoa. Bye-bye, oh, stop by the door, stay home.